You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the second event in the Brazil series, which is a jointly sponsored series between the Fellowship Program's Ideas Initiative and the Latin America Program, following on the last Ideas Initiative on India, was last year?
And earlier this year.
We had our first event on Brazil in August around the protests, and this is our second event looking at foreign policy. And the series will be going on later this year and early next year. For the format today, I'm going to do a very brief intro of Lucia Nader, who many of you know well, and also an introduction for our new regional director, Pedro, who many of you have met and some haven't yet, but we'll be meeting soon, I'm sure. And then Lucia's going to do a short presentation, set of remarks. Pedro's going to comment on that presentation, and then we'll just open for questions and discussion. A quick bio for those who don't know Lucia. She's the director of Conectas, which is an organization that was, I think, very prescient in starting to look at influencing foreign policy issues in Brazil with a particular human rights focus. And Lucia built and managed the foreign policy work of that organization before becoming director, so has a long standing experience in this area. Pedro, our new director, who started last week, comes to us with many years of experience in Brazil's Ministry of Justice, having served in a number of key posts between 2004 and 2011, and most recently was a professor at the Fundação Getúlio Vargas Law School in Rio, as well as campaign director for Avaaz, working on a series of corruption and human rights issues in Latin America as campaign director. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And I'll let Lucia get started.
Perfect. So, hi everyone. Thank you. Thanks for coming. It's a pleasure to be speaking here, as OSF is one of our main partners and donor, but mostly partner, to think through such different activities like how can we monitor Brazil's foreign policy and emerging powers' role in the international sphere. So many, many thanks. I see Jerry Fowler is there as well. Jerry has been one of the main supporters of this work, and I would like to thank him and the Latin American program. Now with Pedro, old friend in front. Hi, Pedro. For this invitation, but mostly for all the long-term and standing support you have been giving to Conectas and to this foreign policy work. Very, very briefly, Conectas was created in 2001, so we have been working for the last 12 years. We started with a project. One of our main goals at the beginning was to connect NGOs working in the Global South with human rights, so to strengthen South-South cooperation among human rights groups working in new democracies with human rights. Today we have two other areas. One is to strengthen emerging powers' role in the international human rights protection, and also to work at the national level with some pressing issues in Brazil, such as the criminal justice system, and also some other emblematic human rights cases at the Supreme Court and police violence. We have been diversifying the national work in the last years. But Conectas was born with this international DNA of connecting the South. And this 11 years ago, was something new to be created and based in the South doing an international work. This was mainly what NGOs based in New York, based in the US and Europe were doing, but not really an NGO with the compass that is our logo pointing to the South. Regarding the foreign policy of Brazil, the main basis of our work with foreign policy that started 7-8 years ago is that emerging powers could, especially Brazil, could play a better and a stronger role in international protection of human rights. And one of the key factors for this to happen is for them to be more accountable at home about this policy that they develop abroad, about the foreign policy. So to say it very in a very simple way is to deal with foreign policy at the national level in a more similar way we do with any public policy in a democracy. To have a more transparent budget, to have a more transparent modus operandi, to be accountable, to have a role for the Congress that in Brazil doesn't have the role of the Congress that you have here in international affairs, to have eventually a role for the judiciary in foreign policy, how we could check and balance the role of the executive that is the big power in foreign policy in Brazil. So this is the main assumption. You know, if we have more civil society groups and citizens paying more attention to what Brazil is doing abroad when it comes to human rights, and by this I mean how Brazil is voting at the UN and how a Brazilian company is behaving in Angola, this could be a key factor for Brazil to be a more responsible international player. And this would be key for the international human rights protection to be more effective with all the problems that we know this has today, just, I mean, looking at Syria now. What is the legal framework for this work? The Article 4 of the Brazilian Constitution states 10 principles that should guide Brazil's international relations. And the second of it, thank you. The second of it is the prevalence of human rights. The first is sovereignty, and we never mention it. So, and autodetermination, sorry. But the second of it is how human rights should prevail. And sometimes we disagree how to work for them to prevail or not. But we have a legal basis for our work. So when needed, even if I'm not a lawyer, but when needed, we go to the Constitution and we say, be careful, the way you voted regarding North Korea, the UN, is not in alignment with the Article 4 of the Constitution. We did this, they were mad with us, the judiciary questioned them, the Ministério Público, it's one branch of the judiciary, to be simple, not really, but could be. And we do. In addition to the legal framework, there is a long history of Brazil believing in multilateralism, Brazil creating one of the countries that was there when the UN was created, Brazil wanting to be an honest broker and putting people to sit together, to dialogue. This was really strengthened with Lula, that in my opinion did a great work in international relations. Also, I will say what I think it was not that good, but you know, Lula traveling all over the world and shaking hands with dictators or not, and trying to be an honest broker or to find a new way, a Brazilian touch to international human rights protection. And this with Rousseff, the new president, the current president, is not that strong. Having been said that, this is the framework, both historical and legal framework of it. But what every single time we meet with any official of the Brazilian government, we have four arguments that appear on the table and we discuss. Every single meeting is really the glossary of the meetings. Mm-hmm. One is, it doesn't matter if you're talking about Iran, if you're talking about Syria, or if you're talking about Venezuela, or about Paraguay, or about, I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a democracy, if it's not. The first argument that it's on the table is Brazil believes that the international system is selective and is not dealing with Bahrain as it's dealing with Israel and as it's dealing with Guantanamo and as it's dealing, so it's shame, it's putting all the time southern countries on the table, but not really in a fair and non-selective way. The second argument is that the Brazilian government doesn't believe that naming and shaming is the best strategy to protect human rights, and they don't like to name and shame. Brazil likes to abstain, basically, but what they put on the table, and we have the vote tracking of Brazil, it's really a country that abstains a lot. But Brazil puts on the table that cooperation and dialogue is better than name and shame. Third argument, that for any kind of human rights resolution of the UN Human Rights Council to work, there is a need for regional support. So if we are talking about Sudan, we need South Africa on board. And the fourth argument is that economic and social rights should have the same value that civil and political rights. It's impossible to say that these four arguments are wrong. I truly believe that the system is selective. I truly believe that name and shame is not enough. And I truly agree that regional cooperation is good and economic and social rights are important. The problem is that it's half glass full, half empty. I don't know. Empty full. So the other part of it, what we see is to what extent you denounce selectivity, but you also practice it. For instance, Brazil has never abstained in condemning Israel. What I think is great, by the way. But how do you, you know, what is Brazil doing to combat selectivity, not only saying that the US and Europe is selective? Name and shame. Is there anything between naming and shaming and giving a blank check? You know, how do you measure if cooperation and dialogue are having effect? Regional support. How many times I was in Geneva and I had some countries like, I don't know, Ghana or Zambia coming to us and saying, please convince Brazil to vote that way because then we can face South Africa. So it's a bit weird to think that one whole country will vote, you know, like this regional support at the end become
hostage.
He become hostage of the regional powers. You know, and perhaps Ghana and Zambia would support a resolution on Sudan, but will not if South Africa is there pressing them and Brazil could play a role. And economic and social rights, for sure, they are important, but they cannot be used also as an excuse to violate other rights and things like this. So again, I firmly believe that Brazil is right in putting this four argument on the table and is being courageous to do so. And Lula and Fernando Henrique did this bravely. What is happening now with the change of Lula to Rousseff? I believe personally that Brazil is still an important player, even if The Economist gives a 14-page report that month about Brazil. And it's funny because the coverage of The economy here, yeah. It's the economy is this one. And in Latin America is the Christ from Rio de Janeiro, going down to the floor.
I mean, crashing and burning.
It's a different one, yeah. Because there was a coverage of The Economist that some years ago was the Christ taking over, you know, like taking
like
off.
A rocket.
Yeah,
going.
Rocket. Right. And now is the Christ going down. I mean, but okay. And I think Brazil still plays a very important role and could play a very important role, but Rousseff wants to be much less protagonist at the international sphere than Lula wanted. And this has changed the way we deal with the government, the way the government behaves at the UN, what is the priority for the government there, and how we can put. And I think, and I was talking with Pedro about this and Eloisa, I think, is it only an issue of the profile of Rousseff? I think there is an issue of her profile and putting economic development first and the way she is a big manager of the government and control things. But there is also, I think, that the way that Lula was dealing and Celso Amorim, the foreign minister, was dealing with foreign policy was at the end at its limit. You know, Brazil needed a new step on foreign policy. To be very concrete, we felt that, you know, Brazil was more or less a teenager and now needs to go to adult phase. A concrete example of this is Brazil came and put on the UN agenda the concept of responsibility while protecting, in addition to the responsibility to protect concept. But they throw it there, and it's been like 3 years, and there is no substance to it. Like, you know, this teenager, very good on marketing, very good on a good slogan, and very good on having a force fight with powerful governments. But when you say, okay, but how concretely do you put this in place? I don't know, this, you know, we are not that powerful. So it's powerful, but it's not. And how do you deal with this? And I think Rousseff is now having to deal with this. If it was not her, another person would have to deal with this growing pain of an emerging power at the international level. Just a very quick word about, so what should we do? I mean, the UN is in crisis, let's say like this. For a long time, but I mean, now it's in a serious legitimacy crisis. We see that emerging powers, some of them are not really emerging that strongly as we were thinking. And new coalitions are appearing. So not that new in date, like BRICS, IBSA, or things, but human rights are starting to be the agenda of this coalition, such as BRICS and IBSA. And the rules for civil society to participate in these coalitions and how human rights will be dealt with by these coalitions are not clear. We know how to work with the UN. We know that, but we don't know how to be present in an IPSA summit. By the way, we went, and I forgot. This is one of the things we did. For instance, in the BRICS summit, we went to the BRICS summit in South Africa, and we launched a campaign at the national level saying, "This is the former Minister of Foreign Affairs saying, Minister, I want to know." You know, and asking him. And the other one is a campaign we launched asking the presidents of the BRICS to say something on Syria, to say something about armed control, to say something about financing. And we did this together with other groups in other countries, and it's always a challenge. We led this campaign to try to pressure Brazil by building a constituency and a public campaign around it to do so. And we were successful. I don't know to what extent Connectus was responsible for this, but Syria was on the final document here. So we think we had some influence. We don't know exactly what influence. Now we will have a new BRICS bank. I don't know if you heard about it. This week there is a big fight that China wants to invest, the first investment, $50 billion. Billion dollars. And Brazil is saying that it's too much because Brazil can only put five at the moment. So the power dynamics are already pretty true. But more than this, will this bank have human rights safeguards? How will the loans be done? Because the National Bank, the Brazilian National Bank for Development, is giving today three times more loans than the World Bank and don't have human rights safeguards. So this is also an emerging power issue. How public money finance the private sector of these emerging companies to act abroad, and how we can deal with this in a BRICS and IPSA context. Finally, to end, I would say Connectus has four main strategies to try to tackle foreign policy issues. One is gathering information. So it's a big issue for us, for instance, to know how Brazil is voting at the UN, because this is not in Portuguese, this is not disseminated widely, so we publish every year a yearbook about how Brazil votes at the UN and Brazil behaves at the UN in Portuguese. And this is, so information gathering in several levels is key for Connectus, and to put this in our website to give people the information they need to do work on foreign policy. The second one is working with others. Connectus really believe, and it's in the name, Connectus, to work with other groups, to network, and to be able to do it in a diverse way. So we work with Human Rights Watch and Amnesty, and we work at the national level. We are the executive secretariat of a coalition working with foreign policy, for instance. So we really try not to do it alone, as we believe it's important to have a diversity of voices and organizations putting different strategies sometimes on the table. Third, advocacy, pure advocacy, such as this kind of things, meeting with the government. Yesterday, on Sunday, we published an article in one of the big Brazilian newspaper about Brazil aid to Syria. So among the 10 first economic powers in the world, Brazil is the last one on aid to Syria. And we mentioned it gave 5,000 US in the last month. And then we took this number from the UN website, and yesterday the MFA released a public notes quoting Connectus and saying we are completely wrong because the right number is that. And we have been using the access to information law to have this number. It's been 6 months. And we use the UN number, and now they are mad with us. So, and there was we knew through a gossip that maybe this was a wrong number, but a gossip is a gossip. And finally, check and balances. So really, we try to foster the Congress engagement with foreign policy. And Pedro and Eloisa can tell this as well. Sometimes we regret, oh my God, why we are trying to put the Congress on this? Because the Congress really doesn't know a lot about foreign policy. Every single meeting you go to try to bring human rights and foreign policy to the table, we hear from the congressman that we have to save the Amazon. And how do you deal with this kind of... putting the Congress in a good quality on the table to balance what the executive is doing. I mean, I stop here, but I would say that as a both an advocacy player and a grantee, I think Open Society should continue to support the work with foreign policy in emerging powers. I know it's always a big contradiction because we still have prisons like this and we have an image at the, abroad of the World Cup and samba. So how do you deal, how do you balance, and this is a daily struggle for Connectus, how do you balance international work and national work? We had this huge protest in June in Brazil. Do you imagine talking about Syria when millions of people are on the street? You know, like, who cares? So how do you balance this? And I would say that the support of Open Society financially and with knowledge, with strategy and thinking together, it's key for emerging power, for organizations based in emerging power to continue to do this work. Very few groups are doing so today. We are working with some groups in India and South Africa now more closely. And a long-term support from OSF, it's really crucial for this, both at the knowledge and financial level. Thank you.
Pedro?
Well, thank you for inviting me for this. It's really great to talk to Dr. Lucia, who is a very good friend. And I mean, I've been admiring what she's doing in Brazil on foreign policy a lot. And she's much more than me and a specialist on this issue. So I'd like to comment, a little bit of this panorama that she gave us, and talk about three episodes that I think are key to understand what is happening with the Brazilian foreign policy, recent episodes. So first, commenting the panorama, I think there is, this idea of Brazil having an autonomous foreign policy, independent from the biggest powers. This was, and against naming and shaming, this was built long time ago, and it was used by Brazil several times during the dictatorship as a way to hide its own problems on human rights. And what I think is different since Cardoso's government, in fact, is that Brazil built a new speech, still believing in autonomy, still believing in cooperation, but now with openness to discuss its own problems. I mean, when I was in government, I went to peer reviews in Geneva, the Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and at the UN. And I mean, the instructions we had is that we should talk clearly and address our problems clearly. So it wasn't, I think what is different in Brazil from other countries that also have the speech of autonomy and not naming and shaming, that this is not something to hide its own problem. And I think this is new on the international scenario, to have the independent speech, but not as something to hide its own problem. But I think clearly I agree with Lucia that we are, what happened with Lula was a very, very special and unique moment in Brazilian foreign policy. And I think it's a combination of using Machiavel of fortuna and virtue. I think it's Brazil was a country that was growing 7.5% a year in a context where the world were in recession. Brazil was the strongest, maybe is still strongest democracy in among emergents, or among the BRICS at least. I mean, really strong democracy that have a voice in the international debate from the South. This was something new. And Virtu, so there was this context that were unique, economic, at least a unique context some years ago. But there was also Lula. I mean, this is a virtue in the sense that you don't have a charismatic president, this charismatic every time. And his interest on foreign policy and the way that his charisma and his personality could open space to Brazil at the global debate was something that, I mean, this matters. This personal image and charisma, this matters. And I think some episodes helped to reshape what could be seen as, you know, this Brazil as a new, really, and the new global leader from the South. I think the first episode was the Iran negotiation. So, I mean, from the Brazilian perspective, what happened, and we have some evidence, but also I'm talking, I've lived, I'm not talking this as an academic, but I've lived this from inside the government. So what happened is that Brazil receives, at the time it was secret, now it got public, but received a letter from President Obama asking Brazil to be engaged in the negotiations with President Ahmadinejad to get a deal on their nuclear production. And they more or less, in this letter, was more or less said what a good agreement could be. And Lula, I mean, went with this, you know, this idea that he was this new global leader from the South, and together with Erdogan, they built this agreement. And the agreement they had at the end was, say exactly what was proposed by United States some months before. Of course, this was some months later, and it was just some weeks before the UN meeting on sanctions for Iran. And what happened is that the U.S. absolutely unrecognized the agreement, and the sanctions were approved just after. And this was really hard for Lula's view on the possibilities to be a broken good faith. I mean, this was maybe the biggest step on the hard game, international, you know, game. And it was like a big deception to say, well, no, you cannot be a broken good faith, because when you are engaged in this time, in this way, you can have, you know, this kind of response for United States and other powerful countries. So I think this was the beginning of the retreat of Brazil, of the Brazilian leadership in this. But then there was Rousseff's election, and she has a complete different profile. I mean, she has good qualities, but one of them is not charisma. I mean, she's not charismatic at all, and it's not and she's not interested in foreign policy. I think this is something clear to everyone who works with them. Her she didn't have the relationship with her foreign policy minister that Lula had with Celso Amorim. It was a completely different situation. And at the beginning of her government, there's another episode that I think is key to understand where Brazil stays now with foreign policy. That is the International Human Rights Commission decision on Belo Monte. That is this plant, hydroelectrical plant that is being built in the Amazon. And this decision, there is a provisional decision, not really strong, but with a strong language. But the reaction, so they asked Brazil to stop the works in Belo Monte, but the answer for Brazil was so disproportional, that Brazil called back, and still we don't have an ambassador to OAS. Brazil called back the ambassador, and still Brazil doesn't have. It's been how many, how long, Lucia? 2 years? This?
1 year and a half, 2 years, yeah.
1 year and a half, and still Brazil doesn't have an ambassador at OAS. Because Belo Monte is Dilma's personal project, she is committed with this since she was minister from energy. So she took it on personal and her reaction. So she's not really interested on foreign policy, but she's really reactive. I mean, she when something is she doesn't agree, she'll take this kind of reaction. And she was, I mean, the advice that she received for her foreign affairs minister or human rights minister was not to deal this way, but she said, no, this is a question of honor and we have to be tough with them in this case. And so she had this dissent. After that, the other episode that, I mean, also reveals the kind of reaction that she can have is the NSA episode. Where I mean, was published that United States have and now Canada also have spied Dilma herself and her advisors, and then it was also and Petrobras and really economic sensitive information in Brazil, and her reaction was very, I mean, so very strong on not coming to the U.S., so refusing this state visit that she would do this year. So I think, but again, not planning as a more broad foreign policy vision, but more reactive and saying, well, no, we are not accepting that. So what I see now to Brazil is, I mean, if you don't take this, I mean, episodes where Brazil will try to have a strong voice. Brazil is not claiming the kind of role that it can have, that Brazil can have at the international level, because I think the president doesn't feel this is important for her agenda, for Brazilian agenda. So what happened is, if, as Lucia said, Brazil was this teenager trying to have a voice before with Lula that got that had got some deceptions, for example, in the Iranian case. I think now Brazil potential in the international debate is clear underused. I think Brazil has still a unique possibility of being a democracy, a strong democracy with strong institutions and strong commitments with human rights at the internal level, but at the same time, a country that can be, I mean, that had can be a strong voice and in G20 and the UN. So I think at the moment, I agree with Lucia that it's important to make the international and the foreign policy an internal agenda, to have accountability on that, because I think the international debate and the human rights debate at the international level needs a country like Brazil being much stronger at the public debate than what we are having now.
Thanks, Pedro and Lucia. I'm going to use my moderator privileges to ask the first question and then open up to folks. And I'm going to try to pay attention and balance between D.C. and New York in terms of the questions. But my first question to both of you is, to what extent does the broader public, and then more specifically other civil society organizations beyond Conectas, care and engage on foreign policy questions in Brazil? What are the main obstacles to kind of such engagement or interest on these issues? And has this changed at all in the 10-plus years that Conectas has been working on this issue?
Should we start?
Sure.
So, I think, I mean, and these are only feelings because we don't have a lot of good surveys or polls on what Brazil, the Brazilian population in general, wants Brazil to do at the international level. I mean, we don't, because there's no culture of talking about foreign policy still. My perception is that the broader public doesn't care. And I understand, by the way, you know, I mean, who it's difficult to care about what's going on in Iran if you still have so many national issues to deal with, if, you know, it's something new, if Brazil is still trying to understand that we are not, we could be now a global player. What is this? So the broader public in general, I think they don't care too much. And this is, In the academic world, there are some researchers that have a very good quality research and papers on foreign policy, but it is still also incipient. We don't have, I don't know if Pedro agrees with this or not, but we don't have very good think tanks thinking about the issue. So this is a big issue because, I mean, when I come to speak about Brazil abroad, normally I read things in English, produced abroad. And I don't think this is a problem per se. I don't think, oh, they are biased because they are in English. Some of them are, some of them are not, as if they were in Portuguese as well. But there is not a lot of reflection and academic production and think tanks and the general public. This one's in the PowerPoint picture in the center of São Paulo. I don't know what they would think. And we have the feeling, we thought about, and we discussed this a lot with Jerry Fowler, about doing a pool and a public research of this. And survey, and we fear about the results. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same about asking if Brazilians are in favor of that penalty. I mean, so how do you ask this? Because I think that some, and we see this from NGOs we work with that are really good NGOs, that some of them, they support some positions of Brazil that we don't. You know, they think like they really have this ideology of the South against the North, in a perhaps, I think some of this criticism is really important, but in perhaps some overestimated way. Regarding organizations, and I started already to talk about this, I think in the last year, I think that some organizations in Brazil, historically and before Conectas, played a role in international arenas, such as in the environment, in other fields, but the human rights group, they were not playing a big role at the UN or OAS or on monitoring at home how the MFA was behaving and building its policy and the other ministries. Now I think it's improved, but there is a crisis of the human rights groups now in Brazil, and it's also related to a financial crisis of some international donors leaving the countries, some way of giving of the Brazilian government to NGOs changing also, and not having a national philanthropy. So the human rights groups are a bit in a crisis, and this is a bit a luxury to work with international issues. I have to think, and I mean, that Conectas work with this, foster other NGOs' engagement. We created a coalition that today 13 organizations are part of, and we run like the produce information every single day for them. We send this to them. We convene meetings to discuss this. But there is still a long, long way to go.
No, I agree with Lucia that... I mean, it's not really important for the broader public opinion in Brazil. Although I think the image of, you know, being tough with the U.S. and everything can count. I mean, it's something that it's seen as positive, you know, oh, Dilma, she should really be tough with the U.S. or something like that because, oh, they're spying us, you know, this. But in terms of, I think one thing you've touched is the lack of think tanks on this in Brazil. I think it's during Lula's government, there was a little bit of reflection. But I remember once when I was at a Vaz and people just asked me, I mean, who is thinking foreign policy now in Brazilian government? And I said, well, good question. And I begin to talk to people at the government, really, you know, people really close to the president and everything. And I think the answer is nobody. I mean, there is nobody really producing. And of course, they're doing foreign policy. There's a lot of agendas on the table. But there's no one really formulating and having a long-term agenda and thinking and discussing that for Brazil right now. Which is, I mean, during Lula's government, we had a little bit of that. There was key people that, I mean, could be influenced and could influence the internal debate. I think now it's really unclear, and I think it's also because we don't have this traditional in Brazil to take foreign policy as something, you know, serious, and I mean, to debate it more, to have more people formulating what the consequences of our foreign policy, or what are the goals of our foreign policy. I think this is something that it's really important for Brazil now.
Well, thank you both again for your comments. This is Maria Teresa Rojas. I'm the director of the International Migration Initiative here at OSF. So therefore, I wanted to bring up migration within the context of foreign policy and the role of Brazil. Certainly, migration, first and foremost, everybody think of it, and the starting point is as national policy, and I know, Pedro, you have had a hand in shaping some of that in Brazil, but I'm much more interested in your thoughts and finding out how much opening there might be in the administration, the current administration, about migration, the role that Brazil plays regionally and also even worldwide in terms of as an emerging economy and a country that is, of course, now attractive to migration. Again, not just within the context of what it means to Brazil, but what Brazil's, what we fear in the migration world often is the proliferation of bad practices and bad laws. We want to be a kind of ahead of the game there and target possibly Brazil in the future to engage with it in terms of it also having a voice on migration at the global level.
Yes, I'd like to hear Lucia on Haiti and the crisis we had with Haitians in Brazil. But on a more general perspective, I think migration, I mean, taking aside this specific case of Haitians in Brazil, migration is not it's not part of the political agenda in Brazil now. And I think it will be soon. I mean, it's not something in that is discussing for elections or, you know, it's not a political issue, a strong political issue now. And I think Brazil must be prepared because it will be soon. I think the distance, economic distance between Brazil and other Latin American countries will probably make Brazil a very, very attractive place for much stronger waves of migration than we are seeing now. And also the we have had a lot of improvement in domestic work rights in Brazil recently, and some people think that one of the outcomes would be that we'll begin to have, you know, illegal workers or migrants in Brazil doing this domestic work, which absolutely we don't have. I mean, it's really rare to see someone, although, I mean, many medium-class families does have a lot of domestic employers in Brazil. It's really rare to have someone with, a migrant doing this job. And I think this will be the case quite soon. So I think Brazil has the opportunity now to think and to plan a new migration legal framework, general one, before it becomes a political sensitive issue. And I think this is what we're trying to do, discussing the migration reform in the government that unfortunately didn't pass. But I think it's possible to make it pass at this moment, and I don't think it will be in 10 years. So I think it's key to, and I think if Brazil does have a general's legal framework and approach with and it's prepared for this, I think it can really influence the way the world will see migration.
Yes, yeah, so just to add to this, I completely agree. It's boring when both agree, right? I'm sorry. But I mean, I think there is an issue with the culture around migration in Brazil, even if we are in theory, a racial democracy that we welcome people, and Brazil was formed by migrants, blah, blah. There is, we don't know how Brazilians really perceive people, Bolivians come to work and stealing, and I'm here using many commas, brackets, jobs and things like this. So I think there is a cultural issues to be tackled. There is no thinking, strategic thinking, as Pedro was saying, about other issues on foreign policy, about how to deal with migrants. And there is a very concrete legal and structural problem. We don't have a migration law. We don't have a policy, let's say, more than a law. So our migration policy dates from the dictatorship, that is the Estatuto do Estrangeiro. And this deals, and it deals with migration as a police issue. So the federal police is the first one to deal with migrants, the thing. And this is a big thing. And three ministries are responsible for migration in Brazil, and none of them are. Because it's the Justice Ministry, the Defense Ministry, and the Labor Ministry. And none of them say, no, but this is not really our and so no one is really responsible for this. To give you a very concrete example, we have been working with the issue of Haitians in Brazil. And we did a mission, we did a six-month research. We asked information through the Access to Information Law. And we went to Acre, in the border of Brazil. And we saw there 850 and 32 people in these conditions. This is a picture we took there. This they have in hand is the labor.
It's like a worker
a worker permit. A worker. So this was when a businessman arrived, and they were all fighting to have this job, you know. And he's a. We called it a refugee camp and a humanitarian emergency crisis, and the government didn't like the way we called it, because they say we have to not to make it natural, so we don't have to make a big deal around it. But see, there were 832 people sleeping one above another, with 10 toilets only, with kids there, living there, with women together with men. Showers. So how can we deal with this? So if you want, in our website, connectus.org, there are some videos, there are some graphics on how this shelter was made. And after this, we went to Brasilia, to the capital, to talk to these three ministries. And they decided to do a task force that will happen again now, the October 31st. And they want us to go together. And we don't know how we will deal with this. If we are going or not, and we have 20 hours of recording or that are summarized here of Haitian voices, both in São Paulo and there at the border. So I think this gives you, of course, is an extreme situation. It's not that all the migrants are treated like this in Brazil, but there is no policy about it. It has to be done in a more adult way, let's say, again.
Questions? Oh, go ahead, Marla. I'm Marla Lopez at the Grand Center. Just a question of what would you think would be the best foreign policy strategy for Brazil, for the region? If you could pick five things that you think would be the best things that Brazil could engage in the region, what would you say?
Whoa, we know how to criticize. yes, to propose is not really our main skill.
But, adult.
Yes, I'm still a teenager as well. I think just about the regional thing, I forgot to mention that we just got a thematic hearing at the OAS about the Haitians to tackle with the issue at the regional level inside the Human Rights Commission. Yeah. So this will happen the 31st of October as well, the same date of the task force. I think that the region is somehow a priority to Brazil, but I don't know, Pedro, maybe there you have more to say, but sometimes Brazil is still doubt that we are part of the region. So both on the language, on how we deal with the others. The other day I went to Paraguay to do a training on something, and for the first time I had a bit to apologize for being Brazilian, because of the economic power that in the region is, or in Argentina as well, so many Brazilian companies running the Argentinian economy, let's say. So I think there is a love and hate dynamic in the region regarding the role of Brazil. When it's to go against the U.S., then the region is united. When it's to discuss what's going on in Venezuela, then we have a clear division. But I think the migration issue is huge. It should be a regional issue, and Brazil could play a leading role on that. I think the issue about energy is key, because most of these dams are being built in the Amazon, and this has effects in the, you know, the countries of the region as well, and the things that are happening there. What else? The OAS, the effectiveness of the OAS system. So Brazil had a very problematic role in the OAS strengthening process. Now that just the Human Rights Commission strengthening process that just happened. At the beginning, it was a very, I mean, it was a bad position. At the end, they were a bit better. And now we have Paulo Vanucchi, that is one of the independent commissioners of the OAS Human Rights Commission, that can play eventually a new role, and even if he's not talking about Brazil, he's Brazilian, he was at the government, and, you know, he's independent now there, but is a role. But I would say these three key issues, you know, how to strengthen the regional OAS system and its human rights approach to the region, how to deal with migrants, and how to deal with the economic growth / energy and infrastructure issues in a more regional perspective.
Pedro,
no, take
no. Wanda, did you have a question? Did I see that?
Yeah, I was just curious. As the Open Society Foundations, we work on so many issues around open society, and we're always seeing Brazil. I notice with all of our colleagues in many programs, we see Brazil as one that can play a role, that they have all this potential. And it usually comes back to working with Conectas in the end. And I know that you try to work with other national groups on the issues of foreign policy, but how do you see kind of that civil society voice? I know that the, you know, you answered the question of the everyday person on the street might not care that much about it. And I would say, you know, there are other powers in the world that also, you know, the everyday citizen would rather not have them be too engaged globally. But in the case of Conectas and civil society as a whole, do you see any more interest in engaging with the Brazilian government around foreign policy, or do you feel like you're alone in Conectas pretty much dealing with a lot of the issues of open society?
I mean, let me start by saying that we would really prefer you also to have other people and organizations to contact. You know, it's a pleasure and a privilege, but I mean, we are really trying to foster other groups' engagement on this. I think several groups are engaged, and some of them before Conectas, but in specific thematic areas. So you have some groups on women's rights, on environment, that have an international background, that in working with the Brazilian government on this, on development and things, that it's older. I mean, they do this for a longer period than Conectas has been doing. But working with the foreign policy in a more structural, and dealing with foreign policy in a, as I said, as a public policy in a democracy, very few groups are doing. But we have partners that are good partners today. I can tell you, for instance, Inesqui, an NGO based in Brasilia. They work with the budget, and they see, you know, how foreign policy is budgeted in the annual budget of the government, and they do some work. The Baha'i community, they do some specific work about Iran and the Baha'is and things, but we also do a lot of work with them around other issues, or, you know, you have, like, there are some groups, and they are all part of an initiative, or, I mean, some of them are part of an initiative that is the Brazilian Committee for Foreign Policy and Human Rights, that we helped to create, and we are the executive secretariat, but brings together other groups, including the health ministry. is weird, because, you know, there are some ministries inside the government that don't like too much the foreign affairs, and they want to be, they are more in the NGO side on this. But I mean, there is a potential, let's say. But as I said, there are many national issues going on as well. There is a financial decision to be taken, on a strategic and financial decision, if you are going to focus on national or international issue. And this is a daily choice. But I think that, I am optimistic. I think there is a lot of potential. Some groups that were not working with this are now working, but there is a lot of things to be strengthened still.
Thank you.
How would you characterize Brazil's foreign policy and development policy relationship with Sousaphone Africa, specifically Angola and Mozambique, both countries where China is very actively engaged? To what degree, if any at all, is Brazil seen as a kind of counter model to the Chinese model of development? And is Brazil seen as a more trusted intermediary or interlocutor for, particularly for Lusophone countries in Africa?
Do you want to start, Pedro?
No, please start.
I think that our take with Lusophone Africa is more about how the Brazilian companies are behaving there. So Mozambique is the main country where Brazil is investing today, and one of the main recipients of the Brazilian National Bank for Development money through Brazilian companies. And what we hear is a lot around this, you know, like how Brazilian companies are behaving in those countries and somehow benefiting from sometimes not very strong rule of law or democratic institutions. And this is the case, for instance, of some infrastructure companies, like the most famous one. Is Odebrecht, Camargo Correia, and things that they sometimes are doing abroad that we received from partner groups from these countries, sometimes some complaints, for instance, evictions. So some of them were displaced by a Brazilian company in Angola. This happened, and they asked Conecta's help to try to counterpart this. So I don't know if it's as bad as China, or if I don't know even if, I mean, exactly what China is doing there. I don't know if it's as aggressive, let's say, as China. But there is a lot to be done and known about what Brazilian companies are doing there, and how this is being powered by public money through the National Bank for Development. And therefore, there is even a stronger need for the Brazilian government to be more accountable on what they have been doing, because at the end of the day, I'm paying the eviction task force in Angola. So how can we deal with this? There is not really any strategic view for this. For instance, we met with the Lusophone department at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they are more worried about cultural events and linguistic barriers and things like this, you know. And the Brazilian cooperation agency called ABC is also not really transparent. And I don't know if Pedro knows from inside the government, but they are not really strong. I mean, they have to restructure themselves to be more transparent, more vocal, and bigger somehow to regulate the cooperation investments, and not only, you know, like how do we invest in private companies to be in Africa.
I think it's... first of all, I think this, I mean, the explosion of Brazilian presence in Africa is most of all due to Lula. He took it as a priority. He traveled to Africa more than any other Brazilian president before. And I think Brazil, after China, is the country that didn't have any colony in Africa with the biggest number of embassies in the continent. So, I mean, and it all happened during Lula's government. And I think, again, I mean, Lula, of course, Africa was seen as a possibility of new exchange, Brazil diversifying its commerce with different countries. But what exactly Brazil would do that there wasn't clear. The only thing that was clear was the role of our development bank loaning money to Brazilian companies that wanted to do infrastructure investments in Africa, and what happened also in Latin America in general. And I think this is a really big issue, because again, we have this enormous bank, as Lucia said, many times bigger than the World Bank, that is playing a big role in investments in infrastructure in developing countries. And it wouldn't cost much to Brazil if Brazil wanted to have legitimacy in the global debate to establish rules for this bank. I mean, it really wouldn't cost, I mean, to establish rules of how to invest this money and to differentiate itself to, you know, other aggressive countries in the regions. The point is, I think Brazil is not, this is a moment where Brazil is not claiming to have this global leadership on human rights. So it's true that there's no cost, but there's no damage, there's no real and actual damage to Brazil to not doing that. So I think one of the important things that organizations like Conectas has to do is to create this cost of not doing that. Create a cost, because I think if we can manage to make this bigger than the cost of doing, there we could begin to reshape this this influence that Brazil is having in those countries, and maybe begin to shape what Lucia is calling the adult phase of Brazilian leadership at the global debate.
Can I just ask, by increasing the cost, you mean increasing the cost with the Brazilian public or the government?
Both. I mean, it's not something that appears even with Dilma's meeting with a foreign president or that international civil society. It's not something that it simply doesn't appear. Of course, if there were, you know, international pressure on Brazil on this publicly, it will have impact internally in Brazil, but it's not part of the agenda of you know, pressuring governments now. And I think it needs to be, because I mean, it will be good to Brazil to the legitimacy of Brazil in the global debate to have to restructure the way it is investing in other countries.
Can I follow up on that? On the international level, it seems to me that, especially with regard to human rights and foreign policy, that the Brazilian approach, and I think it's true of India and South Africa as well, and maybe Indonesia, is intimately tied up with the whole issue of global governance. And so, you know, when you point out, Lucia, that selectivity is one of the arguments that they make, and then you push back and say, well, you're selective too. The argument's not really selectivity. It's about the system that creates mm-hmm. the selectivity and the imbalance of power, and particularly the relative powerlessness of countries like Brazil, the emerging powers, emerging democracies, democratic powers in particular. And so I guess the question is, you know, can we really address human rights separate from addressing these issues of global governance, and how can we create a strategy that addresses both of them together and is pro-human rights, doesn't, you know, depend upon resolving the issues of global governance, which are going to take a long time before we get progress on human rights.
Yeah, I
agree with the question. I don't know the answer. But,
Why do you think they're paying you the big bucks?
Now, Jerry, I also completely agree with this, but I think it's also, just to add to what you said, for us, like, we have been trying to choose some issues where we could be together with the Brazilian government. You know, so for instance, the Security Council reform, the health, all the discussion around patents, where the for medicines, where the North is not a good player, and things like this. And I honestly believe that this issue about the global governance has also to be tackled in a more pressing way by human rights groups based in the North. You know, like how they deal with their own government on the way they behave at the international state. You know, I see, I mean, of course, we have to have a better behavior and a stronger behavior of emerging powers in regards to international protection. But I truly believe that the US and Europe has also to review the way they do it. You know, this and the way they relate to NGOs that are not based in their own countries, the way they respect or not even things like this. You know, the other, I told you this 10 times, but the other day I was in a meeting and then a U.S. diplomat came to me and said, okay, let me introduce myself. I just received a memorandum that now we have to take Brazil seriously. I said, thank you very much. You know, so, I mean, it's not, yeah. And, you know, I said, okay, I'm glad. So, yeah, you know, I mean, so, yeah, so there is something also to be discussed about the way, I mean, the big powers deal with the rest of the world and how this is. And I mean, I'm far from saying that the North is responsible for all the problems. I think that the Brazilian elite is perhaps more responsible about what's happening in Brazil than the North, you know. And I really don't believe it's about North and South. I believe there are several Souths inside the South. But I think there is much more to be done by big groups based in the North regarding their own country's foreign policy as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this this NSA case is really, I mean, it's there's a new debate that arises from that. That I mean, the internet governance has been closed on the U.S. hands mostly, and the argument for that was that U.S. was maybe the only country that could, you know, really stand for the values of freedom of expression and privacy and well, it comes, it doesn't. So, but the problem is that now, what is the solution? If it is to create and to give the ability to country to create their own internet, that so Rousseff's speech at the UN was that we must have a global governance on that, but what is that exactly? And so what countries from the so-called North must watch is that when they do what what they're doing, as in the NSA case, they open space for a global governance that will be discussed, maybe not on human rights basis. So I think this to create the space to really discuss a global governance and put human rights at the center of it, I agree, it should be at the center of the international agenda of Northern human rights organizations.
And something that I just put there, a picture of, because the other day we were discussing that we feel we are more or less in a jazz band situation where there is no tenant. How do you say the tenant?
Conductor.
Conductor.
There is no conductor at the international. I mean, I think that each of the people there in the jazz band are trying to figure out, you know, how they play their own sound, as in a jazz band, that there is no conductor. And at the same time, it's good to listen, you know, because I think that the big powers are, they like to be conductors. And I don't know if the world today needs one conductor, several conductors. I know this is a bit of a, it's not supposed to be a poem. But I mean, you know, I think that the way of doing international relations that is more, even if we have the UN, having one or two big conductors in the room all the time is being questioned. And I don't know the answer. I mean, I don't think we have all to give our hands and let's go together to do something. But there is something to be discussed and changed, because I don't think this is working as it should.
Is there a question? Yeah, go ahead.
This is Michael Heflin with the Human Rights Initiative.
And I guess you talked about this a little bit, Lucia, but I'm wondering if there's the potential to do more work with existing domestic social movements to kind of craft, an advocacy strategy that both, relates to the domestic issues, but also then connects to international issues. I mean, it seems, and whether that's around issues of discrimination like women's rights or LGBT rights or racial or ethnic minorities, where maybe Brazil, it's not perfect at home, obviously, needs to do some work, but, we can see policymakers and politicians trying to, on the one hand, satisfy or demonstrate to a domestic constituency that's already organized to a certain degree that they're taking steps to make progress at home, but then also, again, connecting that to a broader international agenda. And again, I know that ultimately you're trying to get to a place where there's this more structural approach to foreign policy. But it seems like those would be areas where, or whether it's income inequality, where there would be, potential to really galvanize that local energy connected to and also a complementary international agenda and get the attention of the government more easily than maybe some of these other issues that where people aren't already kind of engaged locally.
I agree, but we don't know exactly how to do it, to be very honest. I think, one, there are some groups like the trade unions in Brazil, even if now they are a bit being questioned as well, they have an international track record that is quite big. They work internationally. Or, for instance, the World Social Forum was created in Brazil and brought together, organizations all over the world and things like this. But I think that a big challenge for human rights groups, either thematically or not, as you are saying, is to rethink the way they relate to their own societies and to social movements. I know this is not really new. We know the tension between social movements and NGOs and how you balance one and the other and things like this. But this became very clear for Conectas. Like 2 years ago, we decided to open, to be much more aggressive on communication as a way to build constituency and to open Conectas to the public for the debate. And we were scared of this debate. It's very difficult to talk about human rights inside Brazil as well. We are seen as groups protecting impunity and therefore responsible for the 50,000 homicides we have per year in Brazil. So, there are reasons for us to be more, not wanting to debate with the whole society and with social movements about it. But at the same time, I see no way we can escape this. The protest in June showed us that, there is much more in there than the organized groups. And that these organized groups somehow aren't really being a channel of participation. So where are they? They are not grassroots. They are not high politics. They are not talking to the streets on these daily problems that brought people to the streets, like the transport, the health issue. We are talking in a macro level of foreign policy, access to justice, improving democracy. And this is not getting people, we are not galvanizing all the people that we could. At the same time, I really think that this is the moment to do it, and we are ready to do so, and some groups are really, really paying attention to this and trying to change that.
I'm going to, unfortunately, have to cut off the conversation a little bit short. First, to thank both Lucia and Pedro for taking part for the conversation, and then everybody for taking part in the questions, and obviously, many of you know and work with Lucia, and this is sort of an ongoing iterative conversation we've been having and will continue to have over the years, and we'll be having now with Pedro in terms of the organization as a whole. So for us, it's
Can I just invite?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to invite you all, on Saturday, our 13th International Human Rights Colloquium is starting. Eloisa is going, Jerry is not, Pedro is not, I'm blaming. One of the activities in trying to broaden the discussion is the first day on Monday, we will have a TEDx format event. And this will be in Tuca, a big theater in Brazil for 700 people, not only 100 people selected to the colloquium to try to debate all these issues. And the subject will be, what about human rights in a multipolar world? If we are really in a multipolar world or not, it's 14 speakers from 8 countries, and it will be webcasted in our website, or the TEDx website, so we can continue this conversation through the website as well on Monday.
Should they contact?
Yeah, the webcast link will be in our website as well, connectus.org.
There you go.
Or feel free to write me.
Yeah, so. Or Eloisa.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.